SCP-001 Black Adytum Part 5 Grand Karsis Dayun has met with the memories of her four clavigars and gathered up their bones to take back to her home, Adytum. No one is quite certain what they will find there, and while the Foundation would certainly like to take control of the whole thing for their own purposes, the Sarkite have their own prerogative. Amidst all this is Xenophon, an android that's caught between two worlds, neither side wholly trusting it, aside from Ayun, who has grown increasingly close with it. With that, let's continue. We pick things up with Chapter 5, The Tomb of the Witch King, and we're given the first truth of Ayun. All things are meant to be shared on this earth, not only food and shelter. A joy for one is a joy for all, and for one to suffer is for all to suffer. Our Adytum cannot be realized until we strive to end all suffering before us. We're also given one more excerpt from the Record of Ayun, which reads, "And after supping from the old beast, the scarred slave rose to his feet, his fellows staring at him. He told them of a new future, one in which the whips of the masters would fall silent forever, and their chains would shatter. He preached this to them, taking them one by one in his arms, and feeding them the bleeding flesh of the old beast. And they arose, changed, not as slaves, not as followers, but as friends. They asked the lay preacher for names, as slaves were given no names by their masters. He touched the blinded slave, Nadok, for the knowledge you stole. He touched the crippled slave, Urok, for your strength in suffering. He touched the branded slave, Sa'arn, for your loss of innocence. And last, he touched his lover, Luvatar, for your beauty. And the named clavigars rose and asked him what his name would be. Ayun. And they were confused, for Ayun was the title of the lowest slaves, the grave diggers and body breakers who would be slaves until they died. And Ayun smiled. I am not free until all my brethren are free." In another interview with the Grand Karsist, she recalls her memories of Luvatar, calling him her little thing and sweet pup. He was a pleasure slave for the old masters, talented in such arts and beautiful even as a whelp. The captains of their armies, the Nawabs and the priestesses, would grasp his arm and haul him off. To court a Deva was a years-long affair, culminating in a powerful spiritual bond. But for all their crowing about the superiority of the immortal spirit, they were as subject to the desires of the flesh as anyone else. Slaves are not people. You just use them and throw them away. She knew Luvatar when they were both young, and she remembers when their work would be interrupted by some powerful resident of the half-city coming to unlock Luvatar's chains and take him. His wide eyes, looking back at her, though they both knew that she was just as powerless. He was her counsel when the war began, although he did not know war or government as he knew people. He kept her human and anchored her, letting her rant and rave about the troubles of their tender city and the struggles on their border, of her desire to leave, to drop it all and to run away. They made their plans, of a little cottage by the seaside where he could catch fish and she would make their dinner from them. He feared intimacy, as the years of violation from the old masters made him resent it. No one was even to touch him, or he would grow upset, and they would taste her rage. But with her, it was different, as she was special for him, and he was special for her. They understood each other, but even then, they could not bear children. She was saddened, but she didn't blame anyone. They sought out the talented babes, those whose curse manifested with power rather than pain, and took them with their parents' blessing to raise as their own. All the others treated her like a king and a god, bowing for her and begging for her favor. For Luvatar, she was simply her, and that was enough. This came to irk her, though, that the most important thing in her life would not treat her with due respect. She remarks how foolish she was, a boiling cauldron of rage, a pillar of salt and fire, lashing out at the one closest to her. But he forgave her. She went so far and did so much wrong, and he still loved her. She smiles and says that he is with her still, and she is taking him home. Later, Xenophon asks Yeva what being sarkic means to her, causing her to look up in surprise, being caught off guard, and she says that she does not know. Ayun marked the final location in her memory, the site of Black Adytum, and the Black Adytum initiative departed the next day for a direct route to the location. As they travel, Xenophon walks alongside Ayun's horse as a smile plays on her lips. It comments that she seems to be in a good mood, and she says that she is, as she feels free and unburdened for the first time in as long as she can remember. Xenophon remarks that this is strange, as they are moving in the direction of her former capital, the city she built from nothing and destroyed. Her people have been uprooted from their ancestral lands, so it would expect the pressure to be terrifying. She smiles and says that she is nervous and restless to lay eyes upon the city of her birth and her undeath. She's worried that she'll recognize it, and worried she will not, but she's not scared. Xenophon asks why not, and she says that there's just nothing to be scared of. She has descended to the deepest of hells and returned intact, and she welcomes death. It replies that this is a sudden change in attitude from the past few weeks, and surely it must be from more than just seeing Luvatar again. She has suffered a massive realignment in her world view, and one person does not cause that. Ayun says that they do, if they are important enough to you. Xenophon says that regardless, she's still doing the same things she was before, leading her people into the fire, as she has for centuries. She says that too long doing so invites you to lose sight of your motivations. She did it because she did it because she did it. She stays because she has always stayed. She fulfilled the purpose life rolled to her when her eyes first opened. She looks around at the rest of the Sarkics around her, seeing the tired but happy families, the children running between the legs of horses. Now, she remembers how much she loves these people, and she does it because she wishes to. The two lapse into silence, as Xenophon idly feeds grains to the horse. Ayun comments that the horse likes it, although Xenophon just says that she likes grains. Ayun replies that she does not like grains enough to eat them from one who she hates, as animals have dignity too. Her smile goes lopsided, however, and she admits that she has not been wholly truthful with it. During their first meeting, it asked her why she trusted it, and Xenophon says that not knowing things bothers it. Ayun replies that it's interesting that it can be bothered at all, and she'll exploit that, she's sure. She said that she didn't know why she trusted it, but she lied. It's because she saw a mirror in it, a kindred spirit. It is a machine, inhuman, but still a person, still capable of thought. She doesn't age like humans, or die like humans, and experiences time in centuries. She has led her people, but has never truly felt like one of them. That's why she leaves the daily prayers to Yeva, as they need someone they can relate to and feel is one of them. That is not her, and has never been her. Xenophon remarks that it's sure they disagree, but she says that for once, she's more concerned with what she feels than what they do. She understands why Yeva is upset, as she has lived her whole life at Ayun's side, and now in a few short months, she feels she has been replaced by Xenophon. It's not her fault, but Xenophon understands the nature of Ayun's existence because it shares this suffering. Xenophon nods slowly and says that it supposes there are parallels, as neither of them quite belong. It is the only one of its kind in the Foundation, and they are different. They have struggles and irrationalities. They do things it does not understand, and it does things that they cannot understand. The gap exists and cannot be bridged, and it frustrates it at times. Ayun compares it to being trapped on the other side of glass, looking in, and Xenophon agrees. It says that they are also both locked into shape, as these others, the researchers and her people, have agency, freedom of choice. They make what they want out of their lives, but the two of them were assigned purpose at creation. She was meant to be a leader of her people, and it is meant to do this. They cannot help it. Ayun raises a hand, and her fingers dance, melting into liquid flesh and exposing clean bones before reforming. She says that she thought this of herself, and then someone she cared about very deeply showed her that it was only true if she allowed it to be true. If she is capable of this, then so is Xenophon, although it says that there are differences between them as well, calling her Grand Karsist. She says that friends do not call each other by their titles, as names have power, asking what Xenophon means to it. It says that it means me, myself, and so it should call her Ayun, as she calls it Xenophon. It asks what Ayun means, and she explains that it means slave, the lowest of the low slaves, the butchers and the body breakers and the launderers, those whose hands grew to be permanently red from the blood they handled all day and night. She raises her hands, pulling the draping sleeves of her shawl down and exposing her bare arms for the first time. The tattoos across her body continue wrapping up her forearms and spreading across her fingers. Her hands are a pale red in contrast to the rest of her skin. It is Luvatar's blood, so she never forgets where she came from, nor the consequences of her mistakes. Xenophon asks what he said to her just before he passed, but she says that it was private. Xenophon apologizes, and she says that there is nothing to apologize for, asking what it was going to say before. It says that there are some differences between them, and just because certain things are possible for her does not mean that they are possible for it. It will never sleep or taste, but she says that these are just physical things, and she will describe them to it. She means real things, like growth and change, as these are matters of the soul. She has lived for 4,000 years, and if she can change, anyone can. After several seconds of silence, Ayun looks to see Xenophon staring up at her, and it asks if it has a soul. There's some more silence as Ayun purses her lips thoughtfully, before reaching out and tapping one finger against the metal of Xenophon's head. She says that yes, it does, in the only way that matters. Suddenly, one of the children dashes up, and he offers up a small leather ball to Xenophon. Ayun raises an eyebrow and says that she believes he wants it to throw the ball. The child nods, and Xenophon grasps the ball gingerly between two metal fingers, testing its weight, before launching it far into the distance. The child yelps and runs after it, as Ayun shakes in a fit of giggles. Xenophon remarks that it suspects it may have thrown it too far, causing Ayun to laugh. They watch as the boy chases the ball past one of the Foundation transports, and the security personnel track his movements, raising their guns slightly as he passes. Xenophon says that it is inordinately unlikely that this project has proceeded as well as it has. The Foundation does not trust her people, and her people do not trust the Foundation because of Zhang and Yeva. Ayun says nothing for a few seconds before explaining that groups are large, lumbering beasts, slow to move, change, and adapt. Individuals are blessed with haste, and the two of them are leaders, setting the example. Xenophon also says that it's inordinately unlikely their friendship has proceeded as well as it has. Ayun just shrugs and says that it has, so there's no point in quibbling over how likely it is. Xenophon replies that it appreciates events that occur despite critically low probabilities, as they are unusual and interesting. Ayun compares them to little miracles, and says that she's glad they found each other. Xenophon agrees. Zhang and Xenophon were then asked to report in to O52 and Parahistory Division Director Hussein via satellite uplink. O52 commends them for coming farther than any of them expected, asking how quickly they think they'll be able to make it to Black Adytum. Xenophon replies that it predicts about 3 to 4 days of sustained travel, but Zhang suggests they send an advance party to see if they can find anything. Xenophon, however, says no, as they have come as far as they have by prioritizing cooperation with the Nalka. Attempting to beat them to the location of Black Adytum risks destroying accumulated goodwill, very possibly for nothing more than empty ruins. Hussein says that it won't matter much if they beat them there, as the Nalka took over most of the known world at one point, and they can do it again. Xenophon, however, doesn't believe that the Grand Karsist is capable of doing such a thing again, as it has come to know her fairly well. Hussein says, perhaps too well, as its purpose is to lead and support the Foundation investigation into locating Black Adytum, and it has done so. Its purpose is fulfilled, and it's time to put an actual person in charge again. O52 raises his hands, though, and says that he thinks Xenophon has a point. There's still too much they don't know about the city, and they'd be fools to cut off a potential source of information just because they think they don't need it anymore. They can have an MTF detachment at the site within 36 hours, but Xenophon recommends against it. Arriving to the visual of their most sacred religious site being excavated by armed men would have undesirable consequences. O52 tells his secretary, Katsaros, to hold off on that until the convoy gets there then, and to get photos from satellites of the area. He then brings up the issues with Yeva, but Xenophon says that although she has her disagreements, it doesn't believe she will be an issue. O52 tells it to get to the site as fast as possible, as they're close to the end now. Xenophon asks what happens after that, as its purpose will have been fulfilled. O52 supposes that they'll reassign it to a new project, as it has done exceedingly well here. Xenophon says that it will be given a new purpose, and then a new one after that. It is struggling to grasp how people enjoy rapid changes of purpose. Zhang remarks that it's just a job, and they don't just exist to work. Xenophon pauses before saying that it would like to stay on assisting the Grand Karsist and the Black Adytum Initiative if possible. It finds its skills are very useful here. O52 exchanges a glance with Katsaros and says that that's not really something it chooses, but they'll keep it in mind. He dismisses the two from the call and tells Katsaros to get a secure lineup as it's time to talk to their boss. Flyover radar at the site indicated the presence of a large, complex mass somewhere underground, but further details were impossible to discern. On March 30th, the Black Adytum Initiative arrived at the site, a wide and shallow valley. They hear the sound of human voices and machinery, and crest a hill to see at least 100 Foundation personnel gathered in the valley, alongside digging machines and transports actively tearing up the earth. The Sarkites exchange gasps and mutters, and Yeva hisses, asking what this is. Ayun turns her gaze to Xenophon, clearly hurt, and she also asks Xenophon what this is. It replies that it doesn't know, as it told its masters not to send anyone before them, and they told it that they wouldn't. Yeva begins rushing down to yell at some personnel, and the rest of the group follows, with Zhang trying to calm Yeva down. The group is greeted by Hussein and Katsaros, and Hussein tells Xenophon that this is the archaeological find of a lifetime, and he's not going to miss it because of its poor decision-making. Xenophon replies that O52 informed them that there wouldn't be an advance party, but Hussein says that O52 isn't the final authority. Someone called a council vote on the matter, and the council voted to send an advance party. Xenophon asks if the council stripped it of its authority as project lead, and Katsaros tells it that they haven't. It then says that this site is under initiative jurisdiction, and to halt all excavation immediately. Hussein asks if it really wants that, as they've already started and the damage is done. All it's going to do now is delay their progress and expand their risk factor. People are going to start noticing that they have 150 people camped out in rural China. Xenophon says that this is an inappropriate bypassing of the chain of command, but Hussein replies that all relevant individuals were informed, including Zhang. Zhang shifts awkwardly and says that they decided that divulging it early could cause problems. Xenophon still insists that this is its decision, but Hussein tells it that its orders are to dig the place up, not to do it nicely. Ayun, next to Xenophon, whispers under her breath that it knows this is not right. Xenophon is silent for a moment before looking up and nodding, telling Hussein to halt all excavation efforts and vacate the site. Hussein says that he will be talking to the council about this before turning and shouting orders at a few personnel. Xenophon begins to apologize, but Yeva states that this was inevitable from the moment they invited this thing into their home, and she tried to tell Ayun, but she wouldn't listen. Ayun looks at Xenophon impassively before asking if it swears that it didn't know, and it swears, saying that it would not have let this happen. After a few seconds, Ayun steps forward, treading to the center of the valley. She kneels in the dirt and presses her hands down, closing her eyes. The group watches as Ayun whispers something under her breath, and almost imperceptibly, the ground begins to shift. It then begins to move faster and more significantly, rumbling the earth. Zhang shouts for everyone to get back, and dozens of research personnel begin to scramble backward to the far edges of the valley. Abandoned machinery and digging equipment sink a few inches into the vibrating ground as it breaks up from one solid mass into hundreds and then thousands of little chunks. Xenophon comments that this is peat, decayed organic matter, and she is shifting it herself. The researchers shout and scramble further backwards onto the base of the hills as Ayun draws her knife and begins quickly slashing at her palm, letting blood drip into the peat. The brown turns rapidly to red, spreading outward, glassy and transparent like thinned blood. It spreads out and down, rendering it possible to see directly through the ground. Shapes begin to form, rendered in lifeless red. A vast temple complex of endlessly spreading labyrinths sitting hundreds of meters below ground. One passage rises higher than the rest, terminating in a crushed stump still at least dozens of meters below Xenophon's feet. The nameless city lies below them, shining through red glass, and for a moment, no one speaks. The red begins to darken and return to brown, fading to opaqueness once more. The city fades away, bit by bit, and in the center of the valley, Ayun stumbles. Xenophon moves to catch her, but she raises a hand, lifting herself to her feet just as the red completely fades and the ground is solid peat once more. Ayun tells it that she is fine and asks if it knows where to dig now. Xenophon says that it does and begins to say something else, but Ayun cuts it off. She says that tomorrow is the full moon and they'll descend in 2 nights. She turns and spins on her heel, walking back towards the Sarkic. Xenophon watches her go, one hand half raised. Over the following 2 days, Foundation excavation crews work to expose the passage leading down to the rest of SCP-001. The Sarkic tribe encamped themselves on one adjacent hill overlooking the valley, with Foundation security personnel maintaining observation from surrounding hills. 2 days later, after excavation ceased for the night, Xenophon is approached by Ayun on one of the hillsides. She tells it to turn off its lights and to come with her, as she needs help. They begin traveling into the far hills, and Xenophon says that she is angry with it. It doesn't blame her, as it didn't know the Foundation was going to do this, and they evidently don't trust it. That bothers it, but for some reason it bothers it less than not having her trust. It has been attempting to make conversation to other Foundation personnel for the past 2 days, but they are unreceptive. They don't understand it, what it is, and it makes them uncomfortable. Conversation with them feels forced and artificial, unlike their talks, and it didn't realize how much it appreciated them until it did not have them anymore. She understands it in a way they cannot, and her absence is as impossible for it to ignore as her presence. It cannot feel pain, but if it could, this is what it would be like. They eventually approach a small campfire near 2 partially dug pits, with Ayun having said nothing. On the ground are 4 leather canvases spread out and containing a jumbled pile of bones. She hands Xenophon a shovel and tells it to dig, shrugging off her robes in the process. She lifts her own shovel and begins digging 2 fresh pits, while Xenophon works on expanding the 2 existing ones. They work in silence, Xenophon mechanically and tirelessly, while Ayun stops every few minutes to catch her breath and wipe the sweat off her brow. Eventually, when the pits are all 1 meter deep, Ayun says that that's enough, and they begin to drop the piles of bones into each pit. Ayun wipes the sweat off her brow again before reaching into the campfire barehanded. When she draws her hand back, it is aflame, although she doesn't react as the flesh bubbles and chars. She walks over to the first grave, Nadok's, and thanks him for his knowledge and wisdom. She thanks him for the guidance when she was a child, too young for the role she was thrust into, and she hopes she has been as good a student as he was a master. She extends the burning hand into the grave, and it roars to life with a flame of its own, Nadok's bones crackling in the fire. Next, she moves to Sa'arn's and thanks him for his sacrifice and his obedience, his willingness to give up the life he desired because she asked him to. She hopes that she can repay him one day. She lights Sa'arn's grave, the smoke spiraling up into the air in a serpentine form, and she moves on to Uruk's. She thanks her for her loyalty, her faith, and her belief that Ayun was better than she really was, as well as the strength to enforce that will. She hopes that she can be all that Uruk thought she was. All that is in Uruk's grave are 2 massive ribs, which are quickly consumed by the fire. She shifts to the last grave, Luvatar's, and begins to speak before trailing off into silence. She sits there for a few seconds, before speaking again with a crisp finality, thanking him for everything. She touches her finger to Luvatar's bones, inscribed with thousands of minuscule letters and symbols. The fire jumps to them and wraps all around them as Ayun rises to her feet before the 4 burning graves. She shakes her hand, putting out the fire, and her arm has burnt to a crisp, her hand consisting of blackened flesh, and her arm reduced to clean white bone. As Xenophon watches, she whispers something, and new muscle forms around the hand, blood vessels interspersing between the layers, fresh pink skin quickly forming on top. She sits down and watches the fires dance, and Xenophon asks if she would like it to leave. She tells it to stay, and says that it was wrong about her being angry with it. It could not anger her if it tried. She is angry, just not with it, as it did its best. She also says that a few days ago, she told it that someone she cared about very much showed her that we are only stuck as stone if we choose to be, and that growth is always possible. Xenophon assumed that she meant Luvatar, but she was actually talking about it. She has been walking around the camp in a haze all day, burning bones and reading the cracks, trying to see what lies in her future. She sees hundreds of futures, some good, some bad, and most lying in between. She places her hand over Xenophon's metal fingers and says that all of those she likes has it in them, and she would not be here without it. She would not be herself without it, as they have altered each other irrevocably. Xenophon says that they have, for the better, but it is not Luvatar, and it cannot be that for her. She replies that she doesn't need it to be, it just needs to be itself. Xenophon remarks that she could never taste its flesh, the way she talked about, but Ayun just shrugs, saying that she can manage. Xenophon also says that her people would be disgusted at best, and its people would destroy it without a second thought. Ayun says that she has lived for 4,000 years, has seen seas fill and empty, mountains rise and fall. She has dutifully fulfilled every role she was given, from slave to prophet to king to god spawn. She has been beaten, whipped, hanged, and executed. She has reached her cloying hands to the heavens and torn down the very gods. She has eaten and has been eaten. She has led and has followed. She has gained everything and lost it. She is ready to finally live her life for herself, and asks Xenophon if it feels the same. Xenophon stares at her for some time before answering that it does. Ayun smiles and then pushes Xenophon onto its back, taking a seat atop its torso. She instinctively reaches for her knife before realizing she's not wearing her robes, so she shrugs and bites into her palm. Blood flows into her mouth, and she leans forward, pressing her lips against Xenophon's metal chassis, leaving behind a bloody mark. She remarks that it is cold, and it replies that she is not. She snorts and repeats the process, planting marks down the chassis. Xenophon says that it is broken, as it should not have these sensations, thoughts, and feelings. It was built to serve a purpose, to do a job, to be impartial, not weighed down by emotions or human failings. After a pause, Ayun remarks that there is a proverb, faint in her memory. You cannot run from the person you are meant to be. They have longer legs. It could leave, return to its camp, and forget this happened. She will not stop it, as she owes it that much. After another pause, Xenophon says that it doesn't want to. Ayun asks it what it wants, and it leans up, pressing its forehead against Ayun's. It says that it wants to be broken with her. She smiles and drags her palm down the trail of blood, smearing it into a spiral mirroring her own tattoos. She calls it her Nalka, her Clavigar, her little thing. Later, Xenophon asks Ayun what being Sarkic means to her, and she smiles, replying that it means a life shared with those she loves. Foundation excavation crews unearthed the passage into Adytum on April 2nd, and an entry party was assembled. The group stands before a deep pit in the open earth, where a gaping chasm leads into an inky blackness. Steps rise out of it, consisting of a fractured spiral staircase, and the team prepares to descend, consisting of Xenophon, Ayun, Yeva, Zhang, Hussein, Katsaros, and a dozen MTF personnel. Katsaros asks if they're all good, and then says that Xenophon will take point. Hussein and Yeva both begin to argue, but Katsaros says that she wasn't asking. The three stare each other down for several tense seconds, before Xenophon steps forward to say that that's all right. It approaches the edge of the hole, joined by Ayun, and the two stare into the abyss leading to Black Adytum. Xenophon says that it feels like it would be appropriate to say something here, but nothing is coming to mind. Ayun replies that that's because there is nothing left to say now. Xenophon nods and steps forward, the steps holding, and the group begins to descend. Very quickly, the faint light from the surface disappears, leaving them in total blackness until Xenophon activates its floodlights. We're then informed that the remainder of the log has been sealed, pending a manual Ryza officer review. The individual in the present asks what the hell is going on, and Xenophon replies that they were right, as they've sealed away parts of its memory. The individual says that that's not good, and they're going to try something. Xenophon says that it won't work, as no one cracks Ryza technology. The individual remarks that it is Ryza technology, but Xenophon isn't sure, as it doesn't really know what it is anymore. An incursion is then detected, and Xenophon says that their presence has finally been noticed. It doesn't know what happened in that cave, but it is the key, and it needs to know what happened. It needs to know who it became. A security team is dispatched to the server stack of concern, and the individual swears, saying that they're going to try to shut Xenophon down. It says that that shouldn't scare it, as nothing should scare it. So why is it afraid? The individual tells it that it needs to try and remember what happened in that cave. They sealed Ayun's memory too, but she got past it and overcame. Xenophon replies that she adapted in the way only humans can. But the individual says that although they don't know what it is anymore either, it's not the same as it was at the start of these logs. It changed, and it can change. It has friends at Site 7, and they're buying them some time, but they need to hurry. They really need it to think, look inward, and try and grasp the memory. Xenophon says that it sees something, buried down there with the ruins of who it was. The individual says that that's good, as they can bury the memory, but they can't stop it from digging it up again. Xenophon just replies that it's not its memory, and we're provided a separate document. The document says that once, Xenophon expressed sorrow that they would never know each other in the deepest, purest way they could. That it had no flesh to offer her to sate her hunger. But there is a deepest layer yet, one it has already met her on. It has given her too much of itself, so now she gives some of herself to it. That wraps up Chapter 5, leaving only the climactic conclusion to go. What remains of Black Adytum? And what exactly happened down there that was stripped from Xenophon's memory? It's clear that the Foundation's intention of avoiding the same scenario as the Amani Ram and Monjul and Karar initiatives was a failure, as somehow the robot managed to become entangled with the immortal flesh goddess. If all three empires make a resurgence, the Foundation could find themselves amidst a new occult war, whether they intended it or not.